Adult religious education classes have a habit of taking on lives of their own. And this was certainly true with American mysticism class. You may remember in February, Deborah Smith and I did a presentation called Roots Hold Me Close, Wings Set Me Free. You'll hear that again later and next week as well. About 15 people participated in 4 weeks of discussion. We knew what we were planning to do. We discussed the rise of a distinctive American mysticism, embodied in titans like Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman. We looked at William James, whose famous Varieties of Religious Experience, written in the very early 1900s, is still in print today. In fact, I saw yesterday in the New York Review of Books, Routledge is publishing a classic edition this month. We talked about the influence of Asian religions on the American religious experience, especially as they emerged on the American stage at the World's Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893, right after the World's Fair. In fact, most of the forms of Asian religions that you know, the various forms of Buddhism, including Zen, Vedanta, that form of Hinduism, and so on, really got kick-started at that time there over 100 years ago. And we talked about contemporary American poets who reflect American mysticism. We all know Mary Oliver, but there were poems of people I'd never heard of that were quite stunning. In fact, we heard one this morning. That's what we planned to do. And we did it. But the 15 people who joined the class brought their own lives to the venture. They freely discussed their own religious experiences, brought poems and readings that were especially meaningful to them, and shared their spiritual insights with all of us. What could have been a class of history and ideas became a class of religious exploration, looking at our past, our present, ourselves. Two of those class members have agreed to share something of their own reflections this morning: Kim Philly and John Colvin. And Kim will talk to us first.
Thank you, Elton. It was a really rollicking class, so hopefully they'll offer it again. Well, this past March, I had the pleasure of taking Elton and Deborah's class with my father. And to save paper, we shared the same syllabus. We passed readings back and forth during the week, Wikipedia entries. Everything was just this crosshatch of highlighter by the time we came into class Tuesday night. And classes were 7 p.m. sharp Tuesday night. And I recall in March that I would rendezvous at about 10 till the hour at my parents' house. And we can get away with doing that because they live a few blocks from here. And what occurred without fail at 5 to the hour was this panic over who had the papers, who had the reading, who had the hot pink highlighter, and we'd finally get out the door. By the third class, my father had decided to just head off confusion at the pass and start collecting everything in a manila folder for the next week. And I can still recall that last week of class and just the panic and rushing out the door and yelling to my dad, "Hey, do you have the reading?" And I heard his disembodied voice shout back, "I've got the file, I've got the transcendental file." And I thought that was pretty funny. As a writer of poetry, I often have to deal in some pretty far-flung imaginative leaps, so I really appreciated that this transcendental file actually existed. It was very Quantico, very kind of spiritual X-Files, and it gave me a heady feeling that we were indeed in hot pursuit of a mystery in this class. I also thought how apropos that two Unitarian Universalists would be rushing out the door with the transcendental file tucked under their arms. So That's a little background on the class. Deborah and Elton can offer you leagues more intelligent background on transcendentalism and Unitarian Universalism and how they overlap. But I thought I could tell you what carrying this transcendental file means to me. To do so, I'll take you back a little farther to the first day of our American mysticism class. We were all reading Whitman out loud to one another, and this was perhaps one of the things I loved most about the class, was the dozen or so opportunities it afforded us every hour to just indulge in reading and responding to poetry. One of us students had just finished reading from Leaves of Grass, and I remember Elton saying, by way of an aside, Whitman doesn't discriminate, he doesn't discern. A few minutes later, I jotted down something Deborah said. I've been born again, as many of you have been. If we look, we can make the common transcendent. Whitman doesn't discriminate, he doesn't discern. If we look, we can make the common transcendent. These were, for me, enticing fragments, humble clues. I also think it's necessary to distinguish between the words transcendental and transcendent. Knowledge that is transcendental is far from transcendent or beyond human experience altogether. Something transcendental is, instead, something through which experience is rooted. Transcendentalists believe that reality could be approached from many angles, empirically, through the study of processes of thought, through an intuitive or spiritual approach, but I think that what they upheld the most was direct experience of the world. And it was transcendentalists of the 19th century, so many of them Unitarians or disaffected Unitarians, who compelled us through the clarity and innovation of their arguments toward what I think was a newfound confidence at the time in appreciating the powers of our own minds, our personal and collective agency, and toward many of the modern non-doctrinal spiritualities we're open to today. I think Elton mentioned that there was a real influx of Eastern traditions and Eastern religion at the time. In introducing his essay, Nature, Emerson, our preeminent transcendentalist, wrote, "Our age is retrospective. It builds on the sepulchres of the fathers. It writes biographies, histories, and criticism. The foregoing generations beheld God and nature face to face, we through their eyes. Why should not we also enjoy an original relation to the universe? Why should not we have a poetry and philosophy of insight and not of tradition, and a religion by revelation to us and not the history of theirs?" Emerson goes on to say, "The sun shines today also. There is more wool and flax in the fields. There are new lands, new men, new thoughts. Let us demand our own works and laws and worship." Does any of this ring a bell? What would our own works and laws and worship look like? For starters, I think, like Elton said of Whitman, that they wouldn't discriminate. And to revisit Deborah, when I think of what it means to really make the common transcendent or transcendental, I think of a mysticism, an enchantment and engagement with our shared universe built around inclusion. Any of you who possess a well-worn copy of Leaves of Grass know how huge Whitman's voice is, that all-encompassing nature that includes so much. And I think what was really radical about Whitman in his time was not just those boil-over lines of this newfangled thing that, you know, they were calling free verse, but what he included or what he allowed for in terms of the subject matter of his poems. In Whitman's world, a factory lathe is as worthy of poetic attention as a classical lyre, and a face scarred by smallpox or disfigured by war can be as beautiful as a maiden's. Whitman offered us a lateral poetics in which old hierarchies toppled. One could distinguish between things without discriminating between them, and even Cartesian chasms might be bridged. To write as Whitman did, and as John so beautifully read, that the body is not more than the soul was not, in the 19th century, a radical observation. To write, however, that the soul is not more than the body was and remains antagonistic to even our invisible notions of order. It is Whitman's hugeness, his inclusive and essentially experiential nature, that has emboldened subsequent generations of American poets to risk their own transgressions. I think it's impossible not to hear Whitman in Allen Ginsberg's Howl in those first few lines. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix. You hear that tortured resilience, too, in him. Through the lens of this class on American mysticism, I also couldn't help but revisit the opening tercet of my favorite poem, George Oppen's Of Being Numerous, which Oppen wrote at the height of the Vietnam War, and hear in it a clearly transcendental statement for our times. That opening tercet is, there are things we live among, and to see them is to know ourselves. It is this faith in one's faculties, in nature and direct experience, as well as the wisdom of multitudinous traditions that we live among, that is, for me, essential to the nature of transcendentalism and Unitarian Universalism. I was born into this religion, so in one sense I've known no other way, but I feel that I've seen enough of the world to appreciate our uniqueness as a lateral religion, especially when contrasted with top-down hierarchies or closed systems of orthodoxy. More and more, I've grown to appreciate our inclusiveness, our ability to define ourselves by what we affirm as opposed to what we disavow, our nature as a welcoming congregation, and our unselfconscious borrowing from the pantries of so many other traditions. This is what Elton and Deborah's class has led me to affirm, and I would like to end my sharing with another passage from Greg Orr's concerning the book that is the body of the beloved. This is a shorter passage. This verse begins where the verses I recited for the reading left off. Well, after the mighty god Osiris has been dismembered by his jealous brother, scattered by passion, as Orr wrote, his parts strewn all over Egypt, and after his wife Isis has wandered far and wide, gathering Osiris's scattered limbs. In the Egyptian legend, Isis can only bring her husband back to life by gathering the fragments of his body and singing a song to restore him to wholeness. I believe as Unitarian Universalist, we all have a good deal of Isis in us, the will and the temperament to look past the fragmented body of our beloved and, through our instincts, art, and actions, resume the hard and never-ending work of rendering that which we love whole again. And now for that last little poem. Isis kneels on the bank of the Nile. She is assembling the limbs of Osiris, her live limbs moving above his dead, moving as if in a dance, her torso swaying, her long arms reaching out in a quiet, constant motion. And the river below her making its own motions, eddies and swirls, a burbling sound the current makes, as if a throat was being cleared, as if the world was about to speak. Thank you.
Our American Mysticism group met four times early this spring, but I'd say that four meetings was only enough to get our feet wet in the great ocean of material that comprises American mysticism. It certainly was not enough time for us to train ourselves to enter into that oceanic feeling which the American mystics, or mystics in general, describe. It takes time to experience the timeless, or it can take no time at all. One thing that mystical literature and talk abounds in is a sense of paradox. We can see this by the mystical experience centering on an inner experience of wholeness, ultimate reality, the nature of nature, unity with all, or union with Krishna, God, Allah, or whatever name one might use, that all of these things go beyond human language. And so it's quite tricky, as one might imagine, to communicate this with others. In spite of this, or because of this, there's an abundance of mystical poetry. For many years, I've loved a great number of the mystical poets from all lands. Our group discussed four luminaries from the 19th century, William James, Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman. I'd say that I'd love all the authors of those four, but I feel a special affinity for Walt Whitman. He has that special dynamism, a lively, all-embracing, passionate style which endears him to me. He inspires me with his style to get hold of those too big for description or definition experiences of my own and craft them into language. So I'd say I'm more drawn to his style. Perhaps when I'm older, I might even have a bushy white beard and hair as he does, but perhaps not. If we look at the passage read by Whitman earlier, we'll find all sorts of insights central to American mysticism. Consider, "I hear and behold God in every object, yet understand God not in the least, nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself." Now, Walt was neither an orthodox nor an unorthodox Christian, and his talk of God doesn't bind him to any particular sect. So it would be all the same to him whether one saw Krishna or Allah or the Buddha nature or even the force in all things, for that matter. It comes to the same essential type of experience. And this is an experience that we have to have for ourselves. It's not something that somebody else has for us. I also like the way he says he doesn't understand God in the least. Too often we hear people speak of God as if God were a big person modeled after a human ruler. However, Whitman in this line confesses that the divine, or whatever we might call that, is simply too much for the mind to wrap into a narrow and neat box. And this connects to the next line, which on the surface sounds sort of egotistical, as he talks about, more wonderful than myself, but really isn't when we look at it closer, because our own experience is what is closest to us, and the experience of wonder depends on our perception with which we see things, and our connection to the divine, or whatever there is that links us to the universe and humbles our limited powers, that thing lies within us. Consider a line from the beginning of Whitman's Song of Myself. "Every atom belonging to me as good as belongs to you." And thus, in that line, we see that we're all interconnected. And so I celebrate myself, you celebrate yourself, and we celebrate the whole universe. Moving beyond the world of Whitman in the 19th century, our group discussed numerous sources and voices of American mysticism for the 20th century. One notable part of that is the presence of actual Zen masters, lamas, yogis, Sufis, and other teachers over the past 100 years who've come to the U.S. and have taught and made their presence known here. Speaking for myself, I was first exposed to meditation by a Korean Taekwondo teacher who was more about spiritual discipline than about competitive sport. That was when I was maybe 12 or 13 years old. But I can say that if I'd lived in Whitman's time, there wouldn't have been many of such teachers like that. You couldn't have expected to just casually come across a lama or a Zen master. Years after my first experience with meditation, I became involved with various forms of Buddhist meditation and yoga. Although many such groups rarely mention mystical experience, mostly because stress relief might have broader appeal than talking about monastic vows or cosmic visions or things like that. And yet I've always had a hankering for such experiences myself. And I think this goes back to my experiences with music of high church, say the Lutheran Catholic church I went to as a child, and a sense of just complete absorption and joy within that music, or my absorption, a feeling of joy within any type of religious art for that matter. In any case, meditation is a widely used tool to attain mystical states by many different teachers and schools, and it's certainly one that I've enjoyed using and have used regularly. Just as the transcendentalists extolled the spirit and nature and ennobling poetry, such as Emerson and Thoreau will talk about Homer and the Bhagavad Gita, so also can meditation involve poetry and an openness to the wonder of nature. And so I'll end my presentation with an example of two types of different meditations. One is focused insight meditation, and one is mindfulness meditation. And of course, you're free to participate in these or not if you'd like. And of course, I only have a minute or so to practice each one. So if you want to explore these in more depth, I'd recommend you spend more than just a mere minute practicing them. The first meditation is one where we focus our attention more narrowly. In this one, you can take some lines. You can even take lines from like Whitman's poetry, or you can take what's called a mantra, or you can use an affirmation saying like, I am successful, or I am happy, or whatever, something like that. Or you can use just a couple simple lines. And with these lines, you can use maybe one line or two lines. And so you might think right now of a couple you might like to use, or one line you might like to use. And you just breathe in and say one line, and breathe out and say the other line, or say the one line you have a second time. And so with that, we're just going to focus our attention on breathing in and out and focusing your attention on this particular chosen word or words that you've selected. So I'll sound the bell, and when I sound the bell again, we'll just shift into the second type of meditation. And now the next type of meditation I'll give you a brief sample of. This next type of meditation is sort of at the opposite end, where the first one focuses your attention very closely. This one broadens your awareness to all of experience. So with this, you simply let the world enter into you, the sounds, the sights, the feelings of warmth, the feeling of the bodies around you. And as much as possible, you know, if you haven't practiced meditation much, it can be difficult. Try to let go of the train of thought within your head, the judgments that come up within your head, and just try to imagine as if everything going on around us is sort of like a river, and you're just part of that river. And as you do the meditation, breathing in and breathing out, you just sort of surrender to your sense experience and let yourself flow with that. And just be aware of everything that comes up, everything. If you notice a sound, just be aware of that and then let it go. If you're aware of it being too warm in the room, just be aware of that and let it go. And so with this, unlike the first one, you have a very broad and all-expansive focus, but at the same time, you're not focusing on your own little issues inside. So when I sound the bell, breathe in and out and try to expand your awareness. So clearly that was a very brief exposure to those different types of meditation. And both those have been very dear to me. I've practiced both those with both those types and other types of meditation quite a bit. And that's very much part of the spirit of American mysticism in the 20th century in particular, where there's been a lot more of applied disciplines, such as much more wide use of yoga and meditation and tai chi and things like that. Just to conclude, I'd like to say that it's experiences like these, coming from meditation or from yoga, or from reading the writings of the different American mystic authors or other mystic authors, that all of these things have really deepened and enriched my own life. And so I'm just really grateful that I've been was able to be part of this discussion group at the UU, and that we were able to explore and enjoy some of the more beautiful flowers and the boundless spring fields of mystical literature.